Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lady Beecham's Proposal by Amy Rose Bennett, narrated by Hannah Martin. Prologue. Harcourt House, London, September 1815. Elizabeth Harcourt, Lady Beecham, sat before her cherrywood dressing table, determinedly brushing her hair with slow, methodical strokes, trying in vain to relax. The simple routine always used to be soothing, a balm to her taut nerves. But not anymore, especially not tonight. The long case clock in the hall outside suddenly heralded the hour, midnight. With a shaky sigh, Elizabeth placed the brush upon the silver tray and glanced at her candle-lit reflection. A grave young woman stared back at her. Shadows as dark as bruises marred the pale skin beneath her grey eyes. She was so tired, and so anxious, she felt as brittle as a dried-out birch twig that was going to snap at any moment. But she couldn't break now. All going well, in 6 hours she would be gone from here, in a hired hackney cab that was scheduled to arrive in the mews behind the servants' entrance, where her travelling trunk had been carefully stowed. Despite her fatigue, she doubted that she would be able to sleep at all between now and then. There was too much at stake. The unexpected sound of her bedroom door opening made her start. In the dark shadows behind her, the reflection of her husband's tall, lean frame appeared. He paused on the threshold, and by the way he leaned against the doorframe, it was obvious that he was drunk. Not an unusual circumstance for this time of night. Elizabeth knew that he'd probably spent the best part of the evening at his club or some gaming hell. But what was unusual and caused her heart to hammer against her breast was the fact that he had come to her room at all. Hugh hadn't entered her bedchamber for more than a year. She tried to read his expression, judge his mood, desperately tried to fathom what could have prompted this unexpected nocturnal visitation. But Hugh's blue eyes, indeed, the sculpted planes of his entire face were hidden in shadow.
Elizabeth.
Pushing away from the door, he prowled toward her bed, then, with a heavy sigh, sank onto the pale blue silk counterpane. The lingering odour of port and stale cigar smoke assailed her. Even though Elizabeth's stomach cramped with fear, she forced herself to remain still as she watched and waited. It made no sense at all that Hugh had come to her instead of seeking out the more titillating company of his latest mistress, or a prostitute in a high-class bawdy house, his usual custom at this late hour. Unless, does he know what I have planned? Despite her rising panic, Elizabeth was suddenly struck by the realization that her husband was uncharacteristically maudlin. Turning to face him, she was acutely conscious of the fact that she only wore a thin, white cotton night rail. Although it buttoned all the way to her throat and had long sleeves, she felt vulnerable, exposed. It bothered her that her feet were bare. But she couldn't afford to show any weakness. "Are you all right, my lord?" she asked carefully, forcing the words past her tight, dry throat. It seemed safer than asking, "What do you want?" or "Are you here to stop me leaving you?" She hoped to God he hadn't uncovered her secret. She must tread carefully. Her life depended upon it. His gaze travelled over her, but quickly returned to her face. Grimacing, he then ran a hand through his golden blonde hair, ruffling it into messy spikes. At the age of 28, he still looked boyishly handsome, although Elizabeth had long since ceased to think of him in that way.
"To be honest, I don't know," he replied at last.
Honest. That was a word that Elizabeth no longer associated with her husband. Hugh de Lancy Harcourt, the Earl of Beecham. Strangely enough, she did believe him tonight. He was in a peculiar mood indeed. The silence between them stretched. Surely he could hear her frantic heartbeat. She was unsure what to say or do next. She just wanted him to leave. Please, God, make him leave. He started to speak again, his words slightly slurred.
"It has been a long time since we.
His gaze dropped to her chest, where her breasts were well concealed beneath her chaste night attire. Elizabeth noted that he couldn't bring himself to complete the thought. Perhaps he was going to say, "since I fucked you," or "since we made love." The latter statement would have been grossly inaccurate, of course. In 3 years of marriage, Elizabeth did not believe that they had ever truly made love. Though what he had intended to say mattered little. What mattered was, it was not like Hugh to be inarticulate, or melancholy, or in her room. His behaviour was troubling, and it disturbed her that she could not predict what he would do next. Elizabeth didn't know what to do either. Terror trickled an icy trail down her spine and rendered her mute. All she knew was that regardless of his mood, she could not let him touch her. If he did, she would be damned just as much as he was. Hugh didn't seem to notice her petrified silence. Perhaps he was distracted by his own personal demons. She knew all too well that he had many. But there was one in particular that plagued her. The words of the letter her husband's lover sent to her a mere fortnight ago had tainted Elizabeth's mind as surely and insidiously as the contagion Hugh now undoubtedly carried.
"Your husband has the great pox, my lady."
Elizabeth did not doubt the veracity of the writer, anonymous though she was. She had already seen traces of the telltale sore on the ring finger of Hugh's left hand. The lesion was so inflamed, he no longer wore his favourite sapphire-set signet ring. Dr. Morton had called the sore a chancre, after she'd described it to him. She could not see it now, because Hugh still had his gloves on. Her husband drew in a deep breath.
"I've been thinking."
He began, then trailed off, as if the attempt to clarify where this out-of-the-ordinary encounter was heading was a struggle for him.
"Elizabeth."
He at last met her gaze.
"I think it is time that I got you with child."
Elizabeth stifled a gasp and somehow managed to stay upright. Her hands gripped the sides of her velvet-covered seat. Surely he jested. But no, he was deadly serious. He took off his gloves and removed the sapphire pin from his cravat. Even though he was a few feet away, she could see the mark of the pox. The chancre. Didn't he know that he had the disease? How could he not know? Elizabeth suspected he must know, yet did not care. And what scared her most at this particular moment was that she believed he was fully capable of acting with depraved indifference toward her. He had always been selfish. It obviously mattered little to him that he would be exposing her to the infection in the attempt to conceive an heir. Dr. Morton had warned her that any child resulting from their union would also be inflicted with the pox, and Elizabeth could not countenance such a diabolical act. She had to get away, now more than ever, if only she could make it through the next few hours without Hugh touching her. Strange to think she'd once longed for his touch. As Hugh stood and moved toward her, She summoned what she hoped was a convincing smile.
As you wish, my lord.
Her voice was husky, but not with desire. She prayed he couldn't discern the difference. He laid a hand upon her shoulder. His touch was hot, heavy, deadly. She smiled up at him. Hugh, it has been such a long time, and clearly you have taken me by surprise. I feel at a disadvantage. If you would indulge me, I would like to change into something more pleasing to the eye. I know how you loathe these night rails.
Hugh's eyes locked with hers. Speculation, perhaps even interest, flared in the deep blue depths. A corner of his wide mouth lifted in a sensual smile.
Of course, my lady.
He brushed the pale curtain of her hair aside, and when he dropped a hot, open-mouthed kiss onto her neck, she struggled to suppress a shudder. She couldn't even recall the last time he'd kissed her. He hadn't even kissed her goodbye before he left for Belgium to serve in Wellington's army in April. It was now September. She swallowed and dredged up her voice again. Give me a few minutes. I will come to you in your room. He drew back. She could clearly see his erection, pushing impatiently against the fall of his navy blue silk breeches.
I look forward to it, my dear, he said with another slow smile.
Then, thank the Lord, he left. Elizabeth didn't have much time. Opening the top drawer of her dresser, she retrieved her household keys before slipping out of the door into the hallway. She didn't bother to close it. She was afraid Hugh would hear it. Picking up the hem of her night rail, she rushed away, grateful that the plush Orbison carpet deadened her footfalls. Where to hide? Where to hide? That was the question. She headed for the servants' quarters. She knew there was a spare bedroom. One of the footmen had left their service just recently. By the time she reached the fourth floor, she was breathless. She paused for a moment, trying to control her ragged gasps. It wouldn't do to wake the servants. She recalled that the vacant room was at the beginning of the corridor, adjacent to the landing where she now stood. Fumbling, she pulled out her keys, trying to find the right one. The only light she had to work by was a frail shaft of moonlight that spilled through a small window at the head of the stairs. A door slammed. Hugh was coming. She tried key after key, her shaking fingers making the metal rattle in the lock. Someone would hear her. She brutally choked back a sob. Then, mercifully, a key slid in and turned easily, tumbling the lock. She pushed open the door, offering a silent prayer of thanks to their butler that it did not squeak. Jenkins was worth his weight in gold. Shutting the door as silently as she could, she then locked it again from the inside. It was so dark, she could hardly see at all. But there seemed to be a closet on the opposite side of the small, barely furnished chamber. She swiftly skirted the narrow single bed and tried to open the door, her sweaty palm slipping on the handle. No, no, no. It was locked and there was no key.
Elizabeth.
Hugh sounded closer. Too close. She could hear his heavy footsteps on the stairs. How had he tracked her so easily? Swallowing down a wave of nausea, she glanced about the room. Aside from the closet, the bed and a wooden chair, there was no other furniture. But there were floor-length curtains partly drawn across a small window to the left of the bed. She slipped behind the dusty, moth-eaten fabric and waited, barely breathing, trembling. And then she heard it. The door handle rattled slightly. She bit her lip to stop herself crying out. Please, for the love of God, go away. Leave me be. Don't come in. Don't come in. Chapter 1. Aberdeenshire, Scotland. 2 weeks later.
Please, for the love of God, go away. Leave me be. Don't come in. Don't come in.
Wake ye up, madam. You are having a bad dream.
Elizabeth's eyes flew open, and somehow she swallowed the scream threatening to escape her throat. One of her fellow travellers, Mrs. Mackenzie, was shaking her by the shoulder, but when the woman saw Elizabeth had awakened, she quickly released her grip.
Huff.
The older woman sat back down on the opposite carriage seat. A deep frown of concern, or perhaps it was disapproval, creased her brow. The rest of the carriage's occupants were obviously embarrassed by the situation. Mrs. Mackenzie's husband, a middle-aged gentleman who'd introduced himself as the Vicar of Kintore at the commencement of their journey, studied the toes of his muddy boots with great interest. And Miss Mackenzie, the couple's daughter, promptly looked out the window when Elizabeth glanced her way. Elizabeth cleared her throat and addressed the glowering Mrs. Mackenzie.
"I'm sorry to have discommoded you all," she said, aiming for grave sincerity, but sadly missing the mark, given that her voice was husky with sleep and barely contained emotion.
The remnants of her nightmare still clouded her brain, making it difficult to focus. Indeed, she felt as though she was still hidden behind dusty curtains, in fear for her life in her former home in London, not being jostled about in a mail coach in the wilds of Scotland. With a decided effort, Elizabeth strove to calm her breathing and slow her racing pulse as she reassured herself that she was safe. She suddenly wondered if she'd cried out. She had a strong suspicion that she must have, given the strained atmosphere in the carriage. Mrs. Mackenzie nodded slightly in acknowledgement of Elizabeth's apology.
"You say ye are a governess," she said stiffly,
her disbelief evident. It was more a query than a statement.
"Yes, I am," Elizabeth replied, steadily holding Mrs. Mackenzie's gaze. "But it is very much a new endeavour for me. You see, I lost my husband in the Battle of Waterloo, and given my situation, I must now make my own way in the world." She was surprised how easily the lie rolled off her tongue. She had never been one to lie, and truly hated being forced into carrying out such a grand deception. But sadly, her use of deceit was a necessary evil. She needed to accept that she would have to employ subterfuge for the rest of her life in order to have any life at all. She had become Mrs. Beth Elliot, widow of a British infantry officer, forced to seek employment as a governess in the far reaches of Scotland. The Countess of Beauchamp, Elizabeth Harcourt, was no more. "Hugh must never find me."
Mrs. Mackenzie had the good grace to look suitably mortified.
"Och, I'm so vera sorry, my dear. No wonder ye have nightmares. I do hope you find your new occupation a rewarding one. Why, there must be hundreds of poor creatures like you across the whole country, with no real income to speak of. It is a vera sad time for so many, despite Wellington's victory. My condolences to ye, madam."
Elizabeth inclined her head. "Thank you."
She knew only too well the desperate straits the many wives of fallen British soldiers found themselves in when their husbands had failed to return home. Indeed, up until a fortnight ago, she had been one of the patronesses of the London-based Widows of Waterloo Trust, a charity that she and several of her friends had established shortly after the campaign abroad had ended. It did not sit well with Elizabeth that she had abused her privileged position in the trust. She had effectively stolen a governess's post that could have been offered to another woman who had lost her husband and no longer had a source of income. But then, Elizabeth was also desperate. Even though Hugh was as rich as Croesus, he controlled the purse strings. She had barely any pin money, and certainly no personal fortune to speak of. And with no immediate family left on this earth to help, her parents, Lord and Lady Lydenhurst, had passed away shortly after she'd wed Hugh. Elizabeth needed to disappear, to become someone else, a woman of independent means. She just prayed that come Judgment Day, she would be forgiven for her duplicity. The travellers all lapsed into silence again. Elizabeth, or Beth as she now styled herself, looked out of the carriage window at the desolate scenery. They were travelling along a fairly decent road that ran parallel with the rocky coastline. Under a lowering grey sky, sheer cliffs fell away to great piles of tumbled boulders and shingle-strewn coves. Like the mail coach, the seagrass, wind bushes and purple heather clinging to the clifftops, were being buffeted by a strong gale blowing straight off the North Sea. The wind would be cold and astringent with brine, of that she had no doubt. Elizabeth glanced at the small silver pocket watch pinned to her black widow's weeds. It was mid-afternoon. The small mail coach had left the coastal town of Montrose at first light, so she estimated it wouldn't be long before they reached her destination. The village of Torhaven, and, God willing, her new place of employment and residence. Eileen Tor Castle. Leaning forward a little, Elizabeth squinted at a narrow rocky promontory in the far distance. She could just discern the grey bulk of a medieval fortress, and wondered if it was Eileen Tor. Its name fitted its appearance exactly, if that were the case. The castle looked to be a great rocky pile on a headland that could almost be an island. Waves crashed against the cliffs upon which it sat, sending great plumes of spray into the air around it. It was isolated, inhospitable. It was perfect. Now she just had to convince Eileen Tor's master, the Marquess of Rothsborough, that he required her services. Elizabeth sighed and rested her head back against the squabs, stretching her stiff back and limbs. She was so very tired. Her flight from London had begun 2 weeks ago, and since then she had been travelling constantly on stagecoaches, privately hired post-chaises, mail coaches from dawn until dusk, taking a circuitous route northward that would be hard to track. She had already suffered the same nightmare about Hugh's pursuit of her through their London home several times during her journey. But until this afternoon, the dream had only come when she had been alone at the dead of night. The long days of travel and weeks of poor sleep were obviously taking their toll, if she was falling asleep heavily enough to dream on public conveyances. If only the nightmare would dissipate when she awoke. It had started innocuously enough a month ago with the arrival of a letter. Elizabeth had barely noticed the creased and travel-stained parchment in amongst the pile of other pristine invitations and letters on the silver salver that Jenkins brought into her when she was partaking in her first cup of tea at breakfast. Strange how something so inconspicuous could be so noxious. Now the words of the letter had taken root in Elizabeth's brain like a canker. "Dear Lady Beecham, you won't believe me, but I write this missive with the best of intentions. It is not out of a malicious wish to inflict pain, or out of spite that I share this certain knowledge with you, but out of a sense of moral decency, although I will freely admit that is an attribute that I have never possessed, up until this point in my life. You see, I have been your husband's mistress for quite some time now, but I beg you not to cast away this letter until I have stated what I need to say. Your life may depend upon it. Your husband has the great pox, my lady,
or in some circles it is known as the Grand Gore. But the name of this disease does not really matter. The result will be the same in the end if one is so afflicted. Death. You ask, how do I know this to be true? It is because I now have the pox. After an encounter with your husband several months ago, I developed sores, ulcerous craters on my body. And now I have a rash, and worse. But I will not describe the rest of the symptoms of this terrible malady to you, as I am sure you do not care to know about the afflictions of your husband's mistress. Suffice it to say, I am absolutely certain that it was your husband, Lord Beecham, who infected me. Indeed, there was evidence of the pox on his body at the time of our very last encounter. An ulcer on the ring finger of his left hand was the most prominent mark. However, I did not know of its import until it was too late. I pray that it is not too late for you. Of course, Elizabeth had not wanted to believe her husband's mistress. Instead, she had wanted desperately to believe that the anonymous writer, although she claimed otherwise, had only written to Elizabeth out of malice and spite. But then she had noticed that her husband did indeed sport the incriminating mark of the disease. She'd spotted the angry, red, ulcerated patch on his finger when he had eventually joined her for breakfast later that very morning. Her eyes had fixed on his left hand as soon as he'd entered the room. She'd watched his ring finger with something akin to morbid fascination as he'd buttered his toast, picked up his teacup, and turned the pages of his newspaper. He hadn't even noticed her unusual fixation, or her barely contained distress, which was not unsurprising. He hardly noticed anything about her at all most days. She'd had no clear idea of what action she would take that morning. She realized now that she must have been in a degree of shock. It wasn't until Jenkins had inquired after her well-being, as he'd replaced her cold pot of tea with a fresh one, that the idea of seeking a medical opinion had entered her dazed mind. Somehow, Elizabeth had scraped together what could pass for a normal voice. "Hugh, I am going to ask Dr. Morton to call on me this morning. And I wondered..." Hugh continued to read. His article was obviously more engaging than his wife. She started again. "I noticed the mark on your finger." He flicked her a glance over the pages.
"It's nothing."
He resumed reading. "Are you certain? It looks..." He lowered the paper. His eyes narrowed on her, his gaze cold, hard, like bright blue ice.
"I told you it's nothing."
"But
for God's sake, Elizabeth, I don't need you to carp on at me like a fishwife."
He threw the newspaper down on the table, his mouth a hard line, and he walked out. That's when Elizabeth knew that she would have to leave. Even before Dr. Morton had confirmed her worst fears and had warned her about the dangers of sharing any kind of intimacy ever again with her husband. Intimacy. That was something she had never shared with Hugh. Even though she no longer loved her husband, it was hard to love someone who proclaimed you to be as dull as yesterday's broadsheets. It still hurt that the charming, golden-haired Adonis she'd married had turned out to be such a false idol. He'd wooed her, wed her, bed her for a month or so, then promptly ignored her for the most part. And she'd never understood why. The solution to Elizabeth's dilemma had come unexpectedly the very day that she'd received the incriminating letter. After Dr. Morton had departed Harcourt House, Jenkins had asked if she still required the carriage to attend the monthly Widows of Waterloo Trust meeting that afternoon at 2 o'clock. She'd completely forgotten about the appointment and had seriously contemplated not going, given her ongoing distress. But in the end, she had decided that focusing her energies on alleviating the problems of other women in more desperate circumstances than herself
would help to take her mind off her own situation.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?